good?
Yes.
Was it an exciting week last week?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Cozy days and some industrial representatives and that nice CCS. So I assume everybody attended the CCS?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. Very good. So as we talked about yesterday, CCS was a kind of an extension of that particular course with many exciting and important presentations. So I think that is also very beneficial for you for the rest of the semester. And I hope it also triggered some of your interest in addition to the remaining subjects that we will have in the next couple of weeks. Okay, yes, then very happy to have Associate Professor Michael Murdoch here as a guest lecturer. Professor Murdoch is from RIT. So Michael studies the human visual perception of color, light and materials in real and of course in virtual spaces. So he also teaches master level courses in color science. Maybe you can also tell about what you did before you
sure.
Came to RIT. So I asked Michael whether he could provide a lecture in the area of display technology and also amazing perception. So I'm very happy that he said yes. And,
yeah.
So it's yours.
All right. Thanks. Well, yeah. Nice to see you all. Glad to be here. So I would like to talk a bit about displays and lighting systems, which are kind of different, but also kind of the same. In terms of my own background, I studied engineering a long time ago, computer science, human technology interaction. I used to work for Kodak, and I started working at Kodak just long enough ago to be able to actually work on film before film was really gone. And at Kodak, I was able to work on OLED displays. I don't know if you know this, but the OLED was invented by Kodak back in the day. So if you have an LG OLED TV nowadays, it has all the patents and things that we wrote back in Kodak for driving RGBW pixels especially. So still the best TVs you can buy. Unless you have a really bright room, then you know maybe the QLED are arguably good. But anyway. And so, yeah, I worked at Kodak for a long time, and then I also worked for Philips in the Netherlands for about 7 years. And there I also worked on displays for a bit. They were working on, HDR LCD displays, multi-primary displays, that kind of thing. And then I also worked on lighting systems there at Philips, because Philips has a big lighting division, which has since split. The company split between Royal Philips, which is now like, you know, medical stuff, and Signify, which is a strange name for a lighting company, but that's what they do now. So after a bunch of kind of industrial work, I ended up at RIT teaching color science, and I think that suits me pretty well. All my work, the kind of common thread through all of that was kind of like how people see stuff, and especially color perception. So that now that's what I teach, and so it's fun to teach classes in that and get people kind of up to speed. Color science is one of those things that I feel like most people don't know it exists. They say, what, there is a color science? And you say, yeah, and you tell them what it is, and they're like, wow, that sounds pretty cool. So I don't know if you have that experience, if you try to explain what you study or whatever. But they're like, what do you mean you study color? Yeah, and so I enjoy it. And we do a lot of research there. Our program, by the way, is just a master's and a PhD program in color science. We don't have any undergrads. So we get undergraduates from lots of places, from chemistry, computer science, sometimes, you know, art history or other places. And we have to get them all kind of on the same page in terms of all the skills we use, physics and programming and psychology and other things like that. So I put the map in here. I didn't want to assume that everybody know. Maybe you know where the United States is, but it's a big place. I live at that red dot up there, which is kind of close to these big lakes, the Great Lakes. It's in New York State, but it's quite far from New York City. For me, it's about a 5-hour drive to get from my place to New York City, which when I used to live in the Netherlands, I would tell people, it's like, if you got in your car and drove to Paris and then kept going another hour and a half, that's how far New York City is from where I live. And zooming in a little more, this is Rochester, very close to the shore of Lake Ontario. And then I was also pointing out, Peter and I were talking about the lakes, and this little lake here, which is sort of shaped like a Y, is sort of like a miniature version of the Mjøsa. If you think of it that way, it's like instead of 100 kilometers, it's more like 40, but also a nice place. So we're surrounded by lakes. Our climate is not too different, I think, from here. Our summer days maybe aren't as long, and our winter days maybe not so short, but you would recognize the weather, I think, there. So. Cool. So I wanted to start with kind of additive color. Does that phrase sound familiar to anybody? I don't know what you all have covered yet, but hopefully this makes sense. And I promised that I would start with actual math with RGB. Right? So displays in general, most of the time, are pretty simple. They're combining red, green, and blue in some way as primaries and literally adding them together, right? A bit of red light, a bit of green light, a bit of blue light. And you can kind of treat this in math. You could say, what I'm trying to say here, 0.8 times the full red is some slightly dimmed red, 0.6 times the green, 0.2 times the blue. Add those all up and you get this kind of beigey color, right? That's exactly what's happening inside the display all the time. That being said, typically there's some nonlinearity in the system, right? You're not just adding 0.8 times this, it's sort of like some distorted version of 0.8 through there. So when we think about code values, you know, the 8-bit or 10-bit or 12-bit or whatever integers that we use to represent the RGB, they're always pushed through some sort of a transfer function to do that. Does anybody know why?
Is it because contrast doesn't, like, the eye doesn't perceive contrast in this linear fashion?
Yeah, that's a perfect answer. I would say this curve is kind of coincidental. So historically, this came from the specific physical behavior of CRTs, right? When you put voltage into a cathode ray tube, it produces light in, well, the inverse of this curve, right? But it just so happened, coincidentally, that that kind of matches our own visual perception. You need a bigger increase in luminance down here. You need a bigger increase in luminance at the high end than the low end, and so this sort of nonlinearity in the physics happens to match our perceptual nonlinearity, which has the nice convenient result that equal steps in the code value, 0 to 255 range, are almost kind of perceptually uniform, right? Not exactly, but that's kind of a useful thing, which is good for compression, because if you didn't have this here, 8 bits would probably not be enough, or you're going to see the differences between the things, so that's kind of cool. So there's a nonlinearity. The other question, of course, is what RGB do you mean, right? I just drew some colors on the screen there. I don't know what this screen is doing. These two screens are already different. I was just laughing at that a second ago. But here's some typical ones, right? And as long as you know what RGB you're using, it doesn't matter at all. But if you don't know what RGB you're using, then you have a recipe for color problems, right? So Rec 709, typical sRGB, is fairly compact color gamut, and I'm showing these, by the way, in a chromaticity diagram. Is that a familiar space for you all?
Should be.
Okay. Good. I like to describe it as sort of like a floor plan of color space, right? You don't have any information about the luminance dimension, but it kind of gives you a spatial arrangement, right? So the black dot in the middle is the white point. The RGB colors are giving you sort of the gamut triangle, which is the limit of colors available to you in chromaticity, at least, with a given set of RGB. So if your RGBs are further from white, then you get sort of more colors available to yourself. So sRGB is fairly common for all the kind of web interface things. It was standardized for that. Adobe RGB was, I think, designed by photographers and printers because it includes a bit more of like cyan kind of colors that you can make with printing systems. And then Rec 2020 and 2100 really go to like laser primaries. They really hit that spectrum locus because they're trying to like really maximize the color available. So if you've ever seen a real laser projector in an IMAX theater or something, that's one of the few places you can see such a color gamut. You're not going to see that in a, you know, relatively, you know, small projector like this or a normal display. But that's there. And so for colors that are within, you know, the intersection of these gamuts, it doesn't matter which RGB you're using. You can get to the same color, no problem. So as I mentioned, we're talking about additive color. So there's a couple different ways you can describe that mathematically. Here, by the way, I'm throwing the picture of the lighting in there. These are these Philips Hue lights, which I don't know if you've ever fiddled with, but they have a nice little cell phone interface. They're essentially RGB lights, same as a display, same kind of additive color. It's just kind of one pixel at a time. So here I have a, you know, 3 pixels of of light to play with. So anyway, display or light source, this is one way to represent what's happening there additively, right? So this the sort of summation of these vectors S, which are the spectral power distributions of each channel. So the red, green, blue would each have their own spectrum. The little variable P sub I is the kind of proportion or the intensity value that you multiply each of those channels by, sum them all up, and you get the composite spectrum as a function of wavelength from this. So that implies some things, right, that they're kind of independent of one another. You can have a bit of red, a bit of green, a bit of blue. You can also generalize this to any number of primaries, right? It's just going I equals 1 to n. 3 is common, but you can have as many as you want. This summation is the same as this kind of matrix math. Don't know which one you like better, but hopefully that's kind of cool. So here, in the matrix in the middle, which I kind of abbreviated, you have the spectral power distributions just listed as columns for each of the possible channels. You multiply that by the channel per channel intensities, and again, you get the summation of the composite spectrum as the summation there. So that's really a model of what's happening physically, the spectral power distribution of each channel being added up. We often are maybe equally or more interested in what's happening perceptually, right? So you don't need to keep track of that whole spectral power distribution if all you're interested in is colorimetry, right? What reaches your eye. So hopefully you're familiar with the XYZ kind of tri-stimulus values. You can basically sort of shortcut that whole spectral matrix into what I call a primary matrix. It used to be called a phosphor matrix based on the terminology for CRTs. But this column of XYZ for the red channel is really just that. It's like the maximum XYZ measured from the red channel at full power. Next one is green, next one is the blue. Those correspond to kind of the XYZs of these spectral power distributions. So then you can multiply those three channels by the channel intensity values, which we often just call RGB, but those could be the same, essentially the same P that you put there. And you get the composite XYZ out of there. Again, totally additive. So maybe when you learned about XYZ, you talked about tri-stimulus values, right? Tri-stimulus meaning like the amount of stimulus required, the amount of intensity required from those XYZ channels. Do you guys remember what color the XYZ primaries are?
Like short wavelengths, middle and the long wavelengths?
Yeah. Do you know where they are on the chromaticity diagram? Yeah, that's a good point. So, excellent point, right? So the XYZ sensitivities, which are in the other presentation that I'll show you, but you've seen those curves before, right? They were chosen to be all positive sets that kind of represented an old color matching experiment that was actually done with RGB light. And when you make an all positive set of sensitivities like that, it actually means that the primaries that you're representing are imaginary, right? They're outside the spectrum locus, like you said. So that's kind of weird, right? Imaginary colors doesn't matter, actually, because you can translate it. This matrix is actually the transformation between the representation of a color in this primary set to the representation of a color in that primary set. It's just back and forth, linear transformation between the two. So maybe that connects some things you've thought about before. So next thing to think about is what needs to be true, or what assumptions do you make if you have an additive color system? And there's maybe two ways to think about this. One is maybe sort of like, how do you want your display to behave? And the other is, how do you assume it behaves in order to model it with a matrix and a lookup table? A display, say this projector or my laptop. I know my laptop behaves pretty well because I've measured it, and I won't make any promises for the projector because they often do some luminance boosting and things. But one thing that you would like, if you want to use this matrix, you need to have some constancy to that spectral power distribution to XYZ. It means, like, if you multiply it by 0.1, you get the same spectral shape as if you multiply it by 0.9. You don't want if the spectral shape changes, then the matrix doesn't work anymore. So what I'm showing here are a bunch of measurements of, say, blue at different levels, like all the code values, basically, right, from full down to zero. And if you divide all those by their respective peaks, they all line up as, that's a whole bunch of curves on top of each other, but they all look the same, right? So they all have the same spectral shape, and you're just multiplying that whole shape by the intensity. That's good. That means that you have this spectral stability. Another thing you would like is channel independence. So if you drive blue at 20%, and you play green at 20% or 80% or whatever, the green does not affect the blue. Because again, if it does, that means the matrix is not enough to describe what's happening in the system. Another thing you would like is, I mentioned there's a nonlinearity. You need that to be separable, right? So the matrix transformation is completely linear. You're going from RGB intensity values, which are not the same as the code values, to XYZs. And that's fine. But that implies that the nonlinearity is then separate from that, and you can treat each channel separately. The nonlinearity of the red is distinct from the green, from the blue. They could all be the same, they could be different, doesn't matter. So typically then, this equation means, I'll get to that for a second. So the composite spectrum you get is this summation of the sort of weighted contributions of each channel, where this P is some function of what I'm calling the encoded code values, right? So these 8-bit values you typically have, you call them as nonlinearly encoded, transform them in some way, then use those to go through this equation. And the last piece is here is this constant. There may be some non-zero light. It's very common in a display. When you actually set it to zero, it still glows, right? You see some not quite black emission there. So that's accounted for just as a constant offset. And hopefully it is constant, and you can just set it there as a constant, and it doesn't disturb anything else. Everything makes sense? Please feel free to interrupt me with a question anytime if you want. Yeah, that's a good connection. So this set of equations here is basically what's inside the ICCU profile. Like, this is a model of what the display is doing. And if your display has all those nice, handy characteristics that make it simple to model, that ICCU profile will work very well. Cool. All right, so I have another question for you. What is a primary? Is red a primary?
Don't look at me. Don't look at you.
This isn't meant to be a trick, right? Is it? Any thoughts on what makes a primary?
A channel.
Sorry?
A channel.
A channel, okay. So something that's addressable.
Yeah, each individual channel.
Yep.
Calling primary.
Yeah. Good. So if you have 5 or 6 or 7 channels, are they all primaries?
Possibly.
Good. Yeah. This is not meant to be a trick question, but sometimes you run into people in the color world who have a very like firm mindset that a primary has to be a very pure color. And I don't agree with them. So I assert this that what you said actually is a better answer, that some sort of an addressable channel or a unit in your system is really what makes it a primary. The primaries are these vectors. They're the basis functions in this additive equation that you're doing there. So what I'm plotting here are 5 primaries from a lighting system. You probably recognize the blue and the green and the red spectra there, which plot here in the chromaticity diagram. And maybe you recognize this sort of weird black spectrum. Does that look like anything you recognize? Yeah, exactly. And why does it have the funny spectrum shape?
Looks like a D50, D65 to me.
Okay.
Something like that. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, and so this is a typical white LED spectrum, right? Where there's a blue LED actually that's a pump that gives you this spike, and it's combined with a phosphor that converts some of that blue light into like a broadband orange. So when you get that blue plus orange together, it makes a white. In this case, it's plotting here, and I can't tell you exactly if it's either of the numbers you said, but it's somewhere close to the daylight locus, right, in that kind of cool white. There's another one here, kind of faintly plotted in cyan, which has a similar spectral shape, but it's different. Is it white? I don't know, kind of. It's also in the middle-ish of this diagram, but it's up here, right? So it's on the kind of greenish side of white. The makers of this system call it mint. It's like a mint green.
Mint.
Mint, yes. So it's like a mint green ice cream kind of color. But yeah, all 5 of these I would say are primaries. And like I said, I've run into some people who would say, oh, no, no, no. Because you could make, right? Because these colors are inside the triangle made by red, green, and blue, you could actually reproduce this color with some combination of red, green, and blue. And they would argue, therefore, that's not a primary. I would say, come on. It's one of the principal components of the system, so it's a primary, right? So mathematically, it's definitely a primary. According to some color people, they would say maybe not, but you choose your own impression, I guess. Make sense? Yeah? All right, so this leads us to what I think of as sort of a general additive color metric RGB model. This is exactly what we had on the previous slide when I was saying this is what's in the ICC profile. It's sometimes nice to think of this as like a flow diagram, right? That what I would say a forward model is going from left to right here. You have RGB, these are the encoded 8-bit kind of values coming in. There's this nonlinearity, the EOTF. Does anybody know what these stand for, EOTF? Something you run into? It's kind of a device physics way to say it. Maybe Phil Green will get to that. But the electro-optic transfer function, or electro-optical transfer function, which means the transformation from electrons to photons, basically, right? There's a nonlinear, I mean, and it's a property of the whole system. So if you have a display like this, there's software and firmware inside there that implements the nonlinearity there. It's not just something about the physics. It's like when you plug in a value, you get some output, and that's all encased in this relationship. There's a related function is the OETF, the optoelectric transfer function, which would be in a camera, right? The camera takes in photons and converts that to electrical signal in a nonlinear way, and that's the, kind of the opposite. So that can be implemented as a LUT, a lookup table, which is a very common way to do it, or a function. Sometimes people talk about gamma. You heard of gamma 2.2. That's like a power law where you'd say it's, you know, the x value to the 2.2 power, or the inverse of that. So that's the nonlinearity step, which gives you this intermediate RGB. I gave it this subscript lin, RGB linear, RGB intensity values, I often call them, just to distinguish them from the sort of normal integer 8-bit kind of RGBs you get there. By the way, the integerness doesn't make sense. I just keep calling it 8-bit because that's the way we normally call it, right? You can obviously scale that to a 0 to 1 range or 0 to whatever you want, but fair enough. So yeah, there's a nonlinearity. And then you push that through the matrix to get to your color metric XYZ. And as I showed before, like this primary matrix could be just the XYZs, or it could be the full spectral data if you want to model it spectrally. And I've also included the flare here as part of that matrix. You can, of course, put that flare in the matrix if you want a 3x4 matrix, but it's often handy to keep it separate because then the 3x3 matrix is invertible and you can go backwards, which is the other thing to mention here, right? I'm describing the left-to-right path, but there's also the right-to-left path, which is very useful if you say, I know what color I want, and I just need to go figure out what RGB to tell the display so that I get that color out, right? That's, now you're getting somewhere, right? Cool. So sRGB, maybe you've heard of that, kind of a standard for RGB. Often you'll say an image is in sRGB, right? That just means that the pixel values, the RGBs in that image, are designed for an idealized display, which we call sRGB. So actually, the definition of sRGB is kind of like a theoretical display. So there's a bunch of details here, right? It's got a defined white point of D65. It specifies the chromaticities in XY of the RGBs. It specifies the EOTF, kind of similar to the gamma 2.2 function. People often, you know, approximate it as that, even though it's not quite right. It also specifies a viewing condition, which is interesting. So 4 candelas per square meter at a D50 surrounds. So that means you're looking at your monitor and the wall behind it is lit dimly to a 4 candelas per square meter. Do you have a feel for how much light that is? It's not much. Like, I'm guessing just looking at the walls in here, this is not a very brightly lit room. These are probably 200 candelas per square meter walls. So 4 is going to be quite dim. So it's really designed for a dim surround viewing. Most of the time that doesn't matter to you. Often modern displays adapt, right? Their luminance, you pull your phone out of your pocket in the daylight and it's much brighter than if it is inside just because it sort of automatically compensates. It may also change the contrast of your images while it's doing that, which is cool, to trying to correct for some perceptual things that you get in dim and bright surrounds, but cool. Right, so sRGB primaries look like this. I showed you this plot a second ago. And now I can make the distinction between XY chromaticity and U prime B prime chromaticity. Have you discussed those and why you might use one or the other? Which do you prefer? Yeah, so if you remember the history of the calculations, this is a really simple transformation from the XYZ tri-stimulus values. You're just dividing the big X by the sum of the XY and Z, and the Y and the Z as well, which is really handy. And this is actually where you can show where those XYZ primaries would be. The Z primary would be here, the X primary would be out here at 1, and the Y primary up there at 1 on the Y axis. And that makes a really big triangle, which includes the whole spectrum locus. But because those points are outside the spectrum locus, like we said, that means those primaries are imaginary, so that's there. But later, people realized that this is a fine way to represent colors, but it's perceptually not very uniform, so there's a simple transformation from one to the other to get to U prime, B prime. And there, it's still not perfect, but it's better in terms of the uniformity. And what I mean by uniformity is like distances on this. If you're trying to judge color difference on a chromaticity diagram, never a great idea, but it's better to judge that on the U prime, B prime than it is on the X, Y. You know, and one real example for that for displays would be, you're looking at this sRGB gamut, right? And that says that all the colors within this triangle at some luminance, right, are reproducible by the display. But you look at this and you think, whoa, look at all these colors in green that I can't make with my display, right? I better work really hard to figure out what primary I can make to push this green out to make my triangle bigger. But in fact, that green area looks big on this diagram, but perceptually it's not that big, right? And you look at this diagram and you see, oh, okay, that's not as huge of an area as I thought. So trust the U prime, B prime diagram when you're thinking about how big is an area on here. Cool.
Yeah? Can you go back to the previous slide? So as you mentioned. And I think if I remember, that is dedicated for web solutions.
Yes.
So then REC 709, which has similar or the same coordinates for the primary columns.
Yep.
So it's the viewing conditions, they're basically one candela or zero, because it's dedicated for cinema.
So REC 709 is for TV specifically, right?
Okay.
Probably similar lumens. I didn't mention this. The other spec I didn't say here was 80 candela per square meter. That's peak white on the display.
Yes.
This would look super dim to you nowadays. That was based on CRTs. So most laptops are 200 or so, and probably vary depending on the ambient illumination. Yeah, and cinema is really low. It's like 27 or 42 or something like that. It's a very dim. But yeah. But yeah, REC 709 is the same primary set. It may have a different nonlinearity, but it's the same primary set. Yep. Yeah, so I mentioned that the EOTF of sRGB is kind of close to gamma 2.2. So here are the two lines together. The blue one is the actual sRGB, and the dashed one is the gamma 2.2. So you think, eh. Lots of people put this in their code, right? They're transforming code values to integer to intensities, and they just put a you know, power 2.2 or a power of 1 over 2.2 to go back and forth. And, you know, big picture-wise, that makes sense. But if you zoom in down here, that's where you see the difference, right? So these are, you know, tens of pixel values are giving you something in, you know, less than 1% of luminance differences here. So again, you could sort of say, fine, no big deal, that's going to be no problem. The real reason why they're different is because if you do have a power law function, when you get to zero, you reach a zero slope, which is kind of a bad idea if you have any sort of a transfer function to ever get to zero slope, just like infinite slope would be a problem. So the first part of this is actually a linear function up until, you know, somewhere in this range. And that just helps if you're putting pixels this way through, doing some transformation, putting pixels that way through to do a transformation, you're gonna end up with weird quantization things and lose data if you have this, if you use the red curve assumption, and you're probably better off if you use the blue one. So it's at the level of nuance, but you might pay attention to that at some point.
So you will remember that in a couple of weeks doing implementation for it using Excel. So then Phil will again explain the two or the differentiation between using 2.2 and the transfer function.
All right, so remind me of our timing, because we talked about doing displays for a bit, and then probably the last third or so is color matching functions. You have until when?
So basically we have until 1 o'clock, two times 45 minutes.
Okay.
Okay,
so the display part would be a little bigger than
okay.
That, maybe.
Do it in one problem.
Yeah, okay.
So
do you normally take a break, or keep going?
I'm very flexible.
Okay. We'll keep going, and I have some stuff at the end of this display section. If you're interested, we could talk about measurement and things. If not, we proceed. So I want to talk next about dynamic range as a concept. Does that phrase mean anything? And what I mean is luminance dynamic range, like how much difference is there between light and dark, you know, in a scene. This figure is from a really interesting paper. Kunkel and Reinhardt, blah, 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 blah. They were trying to figure out, like, how much dynamic range can people actually see, right? You know that if you go outdoors on a, you know, on a sunny day, it feels a little bright, but, you know, a few minutes later, you're adapted to it, right? Everything looks fine. Then you walk into the movie theater, and you can't see anything, and it takes you 20 minutes until your eyes adapt to that low level, and everything's fine. So we know that we can adapt to this huge range. So the top of this plot is showing, it's labeled like categorically starlight, moonlight, indoor lighting, sunlight. These are all environments that you can navigate, right? Starlight is super dim, but if you've ever been camping on a moonless night and you're sitting outdoors for an hour or two, your eyes will adapt to that. And you can walk around under starlight without bumping into things. You can see enough, right? I mean, you don't see color because your cones aren't working, but you can see enough detail to navigate. And obviously all the way up through sunlight. And that's a pretty enormous range, right? These are 10 to the something like -6 × 10⁸, 14 log units of luminance or illuminance difference. That's pretty incredible, right? And if you've been in like electrical engineering or anything like that, you think of like what's the dynamic range of a sensor or a light output device, right? You don't approach anything near that, right? It's like a really, our own biological system is way more capable than most electronic things, which is pretty cool. So our vision has these different kind of categorical behaviors. The rod function, like I said, at starlight, where it's you're only seeing kind of grayscale. The bright category where you're using your cones, where you see full color. Somewhere in between this mesopic range, you see kind of colors faded out a little bit there. But yeah, you can cover this whole range. The question this paper was getting at was, at any moment in time, at any one of these environments, what's the dynamic range of yourself in terms of a steady state, right? If you are adapted to, you know, our cloudy day today, what is that dynamic range? And so they drew it here with like fuzzy edges. And in fact, the literature gets at, I mean, there's papers on this for ages, and it goes, it'll say, oh, there's like 1.5 dynamic or log units of dynamic range, or oh, there's 2.5, or oh, there's 4 or something. So it's, everybody agrees it's not anywhere near 14 log units, but it's 2 to 5 to 4, somewhere in that. I think this paper came out in the range of 3.8. In some respect, it doesn't matter. I'll leave it at that. But that's it's an interesting question to get at. Where I'm finally going with this is to think about different kinds of displays. So an LDR display, low dynamic range display, a normal display, like probably everybody's laptop and probably your cell phone, has a dynamic range of about 1,000 to 1, or 3 log units. That's typical kind of decent quality, good quality display. Most of the literature agrees that the human visual system can see at least that, or about that, or something in that neighborhood. Some people say 3 log units is sufficient, and there's no reason to have more than that. I'm not sure I buy that. So, so anyway, this paper was trying to measure that and compare it to LDR displays. And they said, well, clearly we can see more than the 3 log units of an LDR display. But if we want an even wider dynamic range display, a high dynamic range display, how wide does it need to be? Right? And so here is an HDR display, which I don't know what it's showing exactly. These authors have talked a lot about like 4 or 5 log unit displays, 10,000 to 1 or 100,000 to 1 kind of things, where they're trying to make the display at least as big in dynamic range as what you can see. So they can show you something that's almost like blindingly bright, and they can show you a black that's almost imperceivable, and everything in between, because that would give you, you know, a really good visual experience. Sound good? So dynamic range is sometimes described in the different ways that I mentioned just now. One would be like contrast ratio. I said 1,000 to 1. I know that this laptop goes from about 350 to about 0.35 in real units of candelas per square meter, right? So that 350 by 0.35 is the 1,000 to 1 ratio, and that's typical of LCDs. Some people will just say, you know, yeah, the well, okay, Y max over Y min is the same thing, right? That 350 divided by 3.5, it's just 1,000. You could say 1,000 or 1,000 to 1. And it's also fairly common to talk about log units for that, so that 1,000 becomes 3 log units. Some photography types talk about stops, which is like a log base 2. So if you run into that, it'll sound like a really big number, but it's only because they changed the base of the log. Fair enough. Does this all make sense? So anyway, the point is that the dynamic range of a display is one of its characteristics, and it's one of the sort of defining characteristics of like what kind of contrast range and brightness and darkness that it can create. So I'm going to talk about two different categories of displays here, because physically they behave differently, and that results in a primary difference, not primary in the color primary sense, a significant difference in the kind of dynamic range that they get. So on the left side of this, I'm calling it emissive displays. These are displays that actually produce light at every pixel. These used to be very common, because CRTs are that. I don't know if you ever had a CRT at home, but I used to. They're big and heavy, and also poor dynamic range. But there's an electron that hits the back of a phosphor, and you get light coming out of that pixel, right? It's emitting light there. Also plasma displays, which were a short-lived flat panel display somewhere between CRTs and LCDs. And nowadays, OLEDs and LED pixel walls or LED walls that you might have seen somewhere. So a lot of phones nowadays are OLEDs, mine is. So again, every pixel on that display is like a little light source. It's an organic LED that emits light when the current gets to it. Same thing with the LED wall, which you might have seen in advertising or in a stadium or something where they have a huge display. Every pixel there is probably an RGB set of LEDs. It just emits light when it needs it. Works pretty well, right? These are able to generate light as needed, sometimes limited by the technology. Like an OLED has kind of a current limit. You can't push too much current through the organic LED or else you burn it out, which is bad. So there's a top end to how much light you can get. But the bottom end, you can essentially turn it off. So what's the dynamic range if you have, 200 candelas per square meter at the top and zero at the bottom? How many log units is that? Well, it's undefined, right? It becomes an essentially infinite dynamic range, which is pretty neat. But it's usually limited at the high end. The other category of displays, I call them light filtering displays. The main category there is an LCD, like this, where there's a backlight, right? There's a big light source behind all the pixels. And all the pixels are doing are closing or opening, kind of filtering that light out. Which if you think about it, is kind of a dumb way to make a display because you have all this light, which you're wasting if you're showing a black screen. An OLED would be much smarter for that because if you have a black screen, you're generating no light and costing no power. But anyway, that's how LCDs work. The LCD technology was developed sooner and perfected to a really high level of quality, and so it persists. But yeah, think about that the light is back there and it's trying to come through and the LCDs are like a light valve trying to turn it off. That light valve is only capable of about 1,000 to 1 attenuation, like reducing the amount of light. And that's kind of where this 1,000 to 1 limit that you see in LCDs come from, because you have that backlight and then you're trying to close it with the liquid crystal itself. The other kind of light filtering display is this kind of a projector. And I don't know if this is an LCD-based projector or a DLP with digital light projection, or a micro mirror kind of display. But either one of those is kind of the same deal. There's a big light source in there, and it's bouncing off or going through a light modulator, which is closing out the light selectively. So again, you're wasting power. Unless you're showing a full white screen, you're generating more light than you need. Make sense? So in contrast to the emissive displays, the light filtering displays, you have a bunch of light, and you have trouble attenuating it. You can't close it down to zero. So their dynamic range, you could make a projector as bright as you want. You go to a movie theater, and those projectors are enormous. They have a chimney to take the heat off the light bulb because they generate so much heat. But they're basically, you can make it as bright as you want, but that light modulator has trouble making black. So your dynamic range is limited on the black end in that case. So these are kind of just opposite in capability, if you think about it that way. This is just a diagram of the liquid crystal itself. This is what's happening from bottom to top is from the light out to your face. There's some backlight, there's some polarization in there. The liquid crystal itself is able to somehow modify the polarization. So when the polarization matches, it comes through, and when it mismatches, it's blocked. And so that's and everything in between is how you adjust how much light comes through. And there's a variety of different ways to configure the liquid crystals, but that's essentially the idea. So you might think to yourself, well, one big backlight for a display, maybe you could do better than that, right? Maybe you could have segmented backlights. So this is kind of the first generation of using LCDs to make high dynamic range displays was to say, okay, well, instead of one big backlight, what if we made strips, right? So if you could imagine a TV, maybe about this size, you have an LED here, LED here, LED here. Each one of those is going through like a light pipe, kind of a plexiglass thing. Coming out, and you can address every one of those separately. That's kind of handy. That means that if you wanted to show a really bright object over here, turn the backlight up here, and the other side of the display, you could turn the backlight down and have something dark. So maybe you've got a really bright reflection off the surface of a car here, and in that side of the image, it's some dark garage, and you can't see right in there. So now you have, across the image, a dynamic range that's bigger than 1,000 to 1, which is cool. But still, at any given like local area, you're still limited by that 1,000 to 1 in because of the liquid crystal, right? You can improve this, of course. Oh, you can improve this, of course, with the two-dimensional version of this. These have become quite common direct lit LED displays, where there's some number in the hundreds, typically of segments behind the pixels. You may have heard of mini LEDs or mini LEDs, which are just smaller and smaller. So you can imagine the smaller you make these segments, the more local control you have over the dynamic range. At some point, the LED size becomes comparable to the pixel size. At some point, you have a pixel, you have an LED for every pixel. Well, then you pretty much have an LED display. So there's something called a micro LED, which is basically that, right? The idea that you could take a glass, piece of glass the size of a display, put a tiny LED at every pixel. And I say put because this is sort of the pick and place robotic things that happens in a big factory somewhere. It kind of works. I think the main problem with that manufacturing right now is just the pick and place variability, right? Because if you misplace a pixel or two, then the whole display is no good. And you're talking about placing millions of pixels on each screen, so it's just a difficult manufacturing thing. So anyway, so if you have this kind of display, which was kind of a new big deal in maybe 2010, pretty common nowadays, you have to address it in an interesting way, right? So this is a slide from Gabriel Marcoux, who works for Apple, I think. But he was showing here, you have an image, which looks like a normal image, but you put some of the low frequency information in that image in the backlight itself. And so you can sort of see here, there's some low frequency information. When you multiply this light source by that image, that's what's on the LCD itself, then you actually get a higher dynamic range image than you would if you just had this on a fixed backlight kind of display. So there's a lot of tricks and patents written on how you optimize this split between the high and low frequencies and whatever, but that's the basic idea. This was actually first pioneered by people at the University of Washington, I think, or Vancouver. Helga Seitzen? Anyway, he pioneered this with a projector. So a projector behind a Fresnel lens and an LCD where you could project a lower resolution image before it goes through the LCD itself, and therefore magnify the dynamic range a lot. And that was the prototype that led to sort of this LED-based thing, which was just a huge, enormous box. When I worked at Philips, we had a prototype of this that actually had liquid cooling running through the LEDs in the back because it was generating tons of light and heat, but that's the idea. Cool. So I mentioned the EOTF. And the inverse EOTF, which is used for encoding. This is coming back to that thing I mentioned at the beginning. The plot I showed you earlier was this, that says there's this relationship, the nonlinearity. This is the human sensitivity curve, right? So this on the y-axis here is Munn cell value, which is not a measurement, but it's part of the Munn cell color system you might have heard about. So the value scale, these steps are perceptually equal. This axis is luminance, which is not perceptually. So both x-axes are luminance. The y-axis here is perceptually equal. The y-axis there is kind of, that's the coincidence that we got with 8-bit. And so here I'm just showing, like, big picture-wise, these curves look very much the same, which is why we kind of get this advantage of the compression in the luminance dimension. This EOTF is, like I said, based on the CRT. It's part of the sRGB kind of standard. It's part of some other standards. There are slightly different EOTFs for other systems. So one system that came out maybe 20 years ago was DICOM, which is some abbreviation for radiography. So X-ray radiologists are looking at X-rays of bones or mammograms or whatever else, typically monochrome. And because they're used to film, radiographic film has a really high dynamic range, a very dark Dmax, a dark density. So you put it on a bright backlight and you can see a ton of detail from where the bones look kind of bright to the tissues that look very dark. At some point they transitioned from film to looking at them on an LCD, and they immediately complained, LCD doesn't have enough detail, there's not enough levels between black and white. So they defined a 10-bit EOTF and a whole 10-bit workflow, because 8 bits was just not enough, even with that nonlinearity. So they defined a 10-bit system that works really well for that. That's still a standard, and you can still spend a lot of money on a radiographic display that's designed for that. And then more recently, we have different EOTFs designed for HDR images and image encodings. And again, part of this is, a big reason for this is to store the image efficiently, right? So this is kind of like image compression, but in the color dimension, right? You want to store only as many bit levels as necessary, but you need a lot if you want high dynamic range images. So exactly which ones do you store? You say, okay, I'm going to limit myself to 10 bits, but I want, you know, to encode the whole range from 10,000 candelas per square meter to roughly zero. How do you distribute those bits so that you don't see steps when you come out? So there are actually 10-bit and 12-bit versions of this. Perceptual quantizer is one way to distribute them. Hybrid log gamma is another similar way to distribute them. Different kind of reasoning behind them, but you might hear of both of these. PQ and HLG both are supported by most TVs nowadays, but if you ended up working for Netflix or something, you'd have a very strong opinion about which one is the right one. Whatever. That's the kind of work that these people do. Make sense? Okay. So dynamic range is like one dimension. Color, which we already talked a little bit about, is another dimension. I just want to talk about kind of primaries and color gamut in a little more detail. So people talk about wide gamut, right? What does that mean? It just means you have a bigger area on this chromaticity diagram, which implies that you can make more colors. Have you ever heard of the 16 million colors you can make with displays? Does it mean anything? It doesn't really mean anything, right? I mean, 16 million is literally what you get if you multiply 255 by 255 by 255. That's how many possible addresses there are in the system. It doesn't guarantee anything about you being able to distinguish all those colors. And kind of like the question about how much dynamic range can you see, people have also tried to answer the question of, well, how many colors can you see? And I would just say nobody knows. Like, nobody's really pinned that down. It depends on too many things, really, right? I mean, you could talk about reflective colors under a given luminance level. You could talk about the colors you can see indoors versus the colors you can see outdoors under bright illumination, these kind of things. So it's an impossible question, I think. But anyway, back to displays. A more capable display has more possible colors, kind of, right? So we talk about the gamut triangle on this, the chromaticity gamut. Some people think this is the whole story when it comes to color gamut. But of course, we're missing this third dimension. You know, gamut is always a three-dimensional thing. If you could make all these colors, but your maximum white is only like 2 candelas per square meter, the whole screen is going to look gray to you, unless you're adapted to starlight. You know, it's like, and even then, you're going to only see it with your scotopic vision, so it's pointless. So what may be more, it's interesting that people use the term wide gamut, because we don't normally discuss or describe the size of things in terms of width, right? Maybe like roads. Like roads are one-dimensional and you talk about the width of a road, but like color space is three-dimensional. Well, even the chromaticity diagram is two-dimensional. So what do you mean by wide on the chromaticity diagram? So I don't know where this term came from. It seems strange to me to describe it that way, but you know that color is really three-dimensional, so it would make more sense to talk about color volume, a larger color volume, if you want to talk about that. But wider, yeah, I don't know. But terminology.
It has been said that if we use narrow primaries, we can have more colors, and that's why we call it wide gamut. It's where we are having narrow primaries.
Yeah, that's weird, isn't it? So narrow primaries give you a wide gamut? I mean, it's true, but it seems like a weird logic, right? Yep. So let's say you did want wider gamut RGB, right? I'm showing here, I think, the REC 709 or sRGB versus the REC 2100, which are the laser primaries. If you do move your primaries, you can still make the same colors plus some more. That's cool. But the recipe, right, the amount of red, green, and blue that you use to generate them is different. And also, the amount that contribute to your white is different, right? So with sRGB, red, green, blue, when they add up to white, of D65 white, the luminance contribution of those is approximately like 20% for the red and like 70% for the green and 10% for the blue. Right, that's because you're much more sensitive to luminance in the green than you are to the other. It's not like a penalty for red or blue or anything, but that's just the way it is. If you stretch your primaries out to this, then green will contribute even more, right? I don't even know if, off the top of my head, but 80% or 90% of your luminance comes from green, and a very tiny fraction comes from red and blue. Maybe that matters, maybe it doesn't. It could certainly have impact on things like pixel sharpness and things. I don't know if you saw in the CBCS presentation about like pixel patterns and stripes and whatever else, like that. This is the kind of thing that can have an effect on that as well. It also potentially has potential for quantization. If you only have 8 bits, 255 levels for everything, and then you say, well, actually my red is now capable of this instead of that, well, now you've stretched those 8 bits out to cover a bigger range. It means you're more likely to see the differences between any consecutive step, so that's a potential problem. So just keep that in mind, right? And again, there's nothing special about RGB. You could twist your triangle and make a display with, you know, some sort of purple and yellow and cyan if you wanted to. Again, it'd have totally different luminance contributions, and it might make some colors that you're used to being able to reproduce impossible, which would be kind of weird. But, you know, it's certainly possible. There's nothing special about RGB, again, for primaries. The last point here about inter-observer variation, I'm going to spend more time talking about that in a few minutes, so I'll just set that aside for now. So, I said this a couple times, but color gamut is 3D. So if you take that chromaticity diagram and you put it on the floor of a more 3D plot, these are discrete points, but these are some of the points you can make kind of on the edge of a color gamut of a display. And so you could imagine that everything inside this volume is part of is the colors that a display makes possible. So you can represent color in three dimensions in lots of different ways, right? So the first one here is, if you just took that U prime, B prime diagram, left it as is, and make the y-axis, I'm sorry, I lost my borders here. The y-axis here is luminance, so the cap y. And you see it really stretches out. And you can say, okay, well, we know that luminance is not a very perceptual metric, so you could convert that to L star, lightness from sea level. And now you see that what used to be stretched out really tall is now squashed, a little more perceptually uniform. It's a little weird to mix L star with U prime, B prime, but this volume is a little more kind of well-behaved. Or you could convert all three dimensions to C-Lab, L-A-B there. That's probably the more typical way to do it. Some might go to a color appearance model like C-CAM, which has similar dimensions of L-A and B.
But the range is same in all these three, the range of the luminance, the scale is same in all these three?
Yeah, so this one has a different scale just because the luminance is something physical, right? But those both have L star as the y as the vertical axis. Is that what you mean?
I just wanted to ask that these both are more like we can cover more luminance range. You have shown a cubic function before,
yeah.
The Newman cubic function.
Yeah.
But in the simple C-Lab, we cannot cover it.
Okay.
So we move to, when we talk about HDR, we try to move to more uniform, perceptually uniform spaces where we can have more luminance.
Okay. What I think you mean, so from here to there, the luminance to L star is basically that cube root equation that you're thinking of. So then you've compressed it to be L star, which is more kind of perceptually uniform. The way we define white determines where 100 is on that scale, right? And so usually for an LDR, low dynamic range display, we would say, well, display white, we're going to pin that at L star 100, and you're just talking about the range from approximately 0 to there that you have available. When you get to HDR displays, though, then this gets a little hazy because you could make a brighter image and you could say, okay, well, I'll just scale everything to the brightest possible color I could make on this and call that LSTAR 100. But that's kind of not fair because that's not really the way you're going to use the display. Right? And I don't know how much you've thought about imaging for HDR yet, but one reason for HDR displays is not just to make brighter images. I mean, people don't really want a theater with like blinding light. But what you might want is the specular reflection off the chrome in some part of the scene to really be bright, right? Much brighter than it would be in a normal display. And so there's sort of this physical boost. And in that case, you would conceptually think of that as higher than LSTAR 100. Because LSTAR 100 is really the lightness of a diffuse white object, right? So a piece of paper or something like that. And you can clearly have much brighter pixels than that in a scene. Anything that's specular or any kind of light source are going to go well above LSTAR 100. So yeah, this gamut volume definition that I'm talking about here, it works pretty good for low dynamic range. It breaks down with high dynamic range, and maybe the next slide gets to that a little bit, but the industry is still kind of arguing about how you define color gamut in HDR displays. My point here is just to remind you that it is three dimensions, and it does matter exactly what those dimensions are. Because you can see this is the same display and the same points, but they're sort of mushed and morphed differently in here. You know? And if you're calculating the volume of one of these lumps, you're going to get a different volume depending on which space you use. So let's argue that C-Lab is probably the best of these. And I point you to some interesting work out of the last few years quantifying color gamuts in C-Lab. So what's on the far right here, these are top views of the A-star, B-star plane, where each of these little loops that you see is like a slice of the gamut. So that same lumpy thing I showed you a minute ago now has been sliced. And one way to compute the gamut is to just integrate those. You say, I'll calculate the area of one slice, the area of the next, the area of the next, the area of the next, add them up, and that's a good approximation of the volume of that space. Because it's actually kind of hard to figure out, like, if you wanted to, like, fit a convex hull or some other polygon to the outside of this gamut and then compute the volume, like that's kind of a pain and they're not always convex and whatever, but this slice method works pretty well for this. So this is kind of like the best way people know how to deal with measuring color gamut nowadays in a way that is actually useful to describe. And one thing that's kind of interesting is that the amount of color gamut that you calculate with these kind of things actually correlates very well with the size, the area of the triangle, right? So a minute ago we were talking about XY chromaticity diagram, and actually it's better to use U prime, B prime. There's this one weird exception that I'm kind of laughing about as I tell you, because the area of a triangle in the old but sometimes useful XY diagram actually correlates really well with the gamut volume for well-behaved RGB displays. If you have an RGBW display, then all bets are off and it doesn't work. But like for like most displays in the world, this is a really interesting correlation. So it's kind of funny that the display industry has been defining primaries in little x, little y chromaticity for years. And us color people have been like saying, come on guys, you gotta upgrade to the U prime, B prime, which is already from the 70s, you know, if you haven't caught up yet. And now they're like, ha ha ha, well look at this, because we are proved right that it's actually useful. So anyway. Funny little tidbit there that the gamut triangle area actually does mean something for some displays. Yeah. So another question maybe is how do you make color? And I don't know if you talk about color physics and LEDs much. Most these kind of displays make color with LEDs. We talked about the white LED spectrum a minute ago. There are a lot of discrete LEDs, right? Meaning a narrow band emission of some color or another made with an LED. Some displays have white LEDs in the backlights. Some of them have discrete red, green, and blue. And I just put these diagrams from an old book about lighting because just to remind you that there are different kind of semiconductor combinations and dopants that determine what color LED you get. And it's really easy to make LEDs kind of all around the whole spectrum, locus, horseshoe there, no big deal. It's really impossible to make a broadband LED, And that's why you get these funny tricks like the blue pump with the broadband phosphor on it. And I think I have a picture of a phosphor ion in the next slide. But so LEDs are quite common. Some projectors have discrete RGB. Some of them have, I can't tell if this is a sequential color or not. Sometimes you can see it. I don't know. But sometimes you might see that in a projector that, I'm going to mention that on the next thing, actually. So light filtering displays, like I said, have some sort of backlight, and it's usually coming through some sort of color filter array, right? So there's this pattern, if you've ever magnified a display to look at it. Often it's a stripe like this. Sometimes it has some offsets or some like chevron shapes or weird things in there. But essentially, each pixel has a colored dye in it, and that white light is coming through and becoming that color. Again, a loss of efficiency, right? It's kind of dumb to generate white light and then filter it to only be red, because you just lost, you know, at least two-thirds of the spectral power there, which is kind of weird. So white light sources, CCFL is cold cathode fluorescent. If you have a laptop from the early 2000s, it might have that kind of light source. Modern ones have LEDs. They could be RGB together or a PC, meaning phosphor converted white, plus that color filter array. So some systems use sequential color, and I was pointing at this projector to say that. Like, it's quite common, especially in kind of lower end, smaller projectors, to just flash red, green, blue, red, green, blue, red, green, blue really fast and change the image every time, so that when you look at it with your eyes, you integrate over that and it looks white to you. Often that frequency of updating is kind of visible, and if you move your eyes across, you know, you have a white thing on a black screen, you move your eyes across and you see this color breakup, like it, you kind of can somehow perceive the separations of red, green, and blue. If you've seen like the Microsoft HoloLens AR system, it has the same problem where if you look, you move your eyes across, it's a saccadic motion with your eyes means you see the distinct channels. So it's one way to make color. It's arguably more efficient than filtering because you're just flashing pure colors like that, but it has some other artifacts that you might see. And then for projection specifically, could be halogen, could be xenon. Some projectors are laser, meaning it's just a blue laser firing on a phosphor, which then creates orange light, and then that's filtered, which seems, again, a bit of inefficient, but the lasers can be quite efficient, and that works pretty well. And then the sequential color is sometimes made by flashing LEDs and sometimes made by a color wheel like this. So you can still generate white light, and you shine the light through this filter wheel so that as it spins, it's sometimes red, sometimes green, sometimes blue, or sometimes it has a white channel like this to boost luminance and distort color. And anyway, these are all possibilities, and it's not worth our time to dive into them, but just want to mention that so you have seen them at least. Questions?
Yeah, before we move on, if it's not too far beyond the scope of this presentation, could you comment on quantum dot LEDs, because that's something I've been hearing about a lot recently?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Good question. Yeah, so this is a really good question, and let me just first say that phosphors are super common, and phosphorescence and fluorescence, anybody know the difference? If you studied chemistry or physical chemistry? I don't really know either.
Fluorescent is like instant light and instant emission.
Yeah.
But with phosphorescence, it's like instant light and during the time emission.
Yeah.
Because it's absorbed and then by energy.
Yeah. And sometimes the phosphorescence has some like energy loss before before it's released. Yeah, okay, cool. So in both cases, you have some material, some chemical element, or not element, but a molecule that's absorbing a photon, right? Typically in an LED system, it's going to be a blue photon. Bluer is higher energy, remember, right? So it absorbs a blue photon that excites an electron, which changes something about one of the bonds in the molecule. And then maybe it waits a moment, maybe it instantly releases that energy, but that excited electron drops back to its ground state, and that energy transition emits a new photon. Right? It would seem that if you absorbed a photon and emitted a photon, maybe you could, you know, get the same thing out that you put in, but of course you always lose something. So it always is an energy loss from a higher energy photon to a lower energy photon, which in color means from something blue to something more towards the red. Right? And sometimes it's quite close by, sometimes it's further. There's lots of different materials that do this. In the world of lighting, they're almost all called phosphors, even though most of the time the transformation happening is fluorescence. So I don't know why people mix up these terms, but they're, for the sake of color, think of them as the same, because it doesn't matter really. But if you're getting into the device physics, you probably want to know the difference. So the plot that I'm showing above there is two different spectral like probability functions. The left one is labeled excitation spectra. So this is like the photon energy in terms of wavelength. The likelihood of it being absorbed is there. So you can see the peak is, well, they're not labeled, but the peak is sort of that grayish function there. The other one, the darker one, which kind of overlaps, is the probability of the emission spectrum that you get. So the whole thing is shifted to the right, which is lower energy, but there is some overlap. And these are probabilistic distributions, right? Any given photon has one energy level, but of course you're thinking in bulk and you have, you know, infinite numbers of photons happening all the time. So you have blue photons being emitted, you have slightly cyan or even orange or something photons, the blue one is being absorbed to excite the electrons, and the lower energy one is being emitted there. So this relationship is just one example, but these are super common and there's lots of flavors of this. So this bottom spectrum is the same one I was pointing at earlier, right? This is a really typical sort of shape where this peak, which you can almost separate from that one, is the blue LED itself, and this other hump is the phosphor emission, the fluorescent material. It emits this sort of broader band orange. So it's always longer wavelength, lower energy, and typically is broader band, but it doesn't have to be. And by the way, when you're designing a lighting system, you can choose different phosphors, which are different color, but you can also choose how much of the blue light is absorbed and converted and how much is not. And if you, this one, there's still a lot of blue light coming through it, and only some of that blue light is being converted to the orange. You could balance it the other way, so almost all the blue light gets absorbed and more of it comes out as orange. And then you can imagine you've just changed it from sort of blue-white to a orange-white. So you can change the correlated color temperature of your LEDs. And I don't mean change like after you've made it, but I mean like in the factory when you're defining it, you can make this balance to produce a D65 white or a 2700K white or whatever you want. And then you can use these as backlights in your display or in your projector or for lighting systems either way. So then finally, we get to quantum dots. So again, big picture from the perspective of color, quantum dots are just a different kind of phosphor. Yeah. Specifically, they're weird because they're quantum. Nanosphere shells. So what they are really small nanoscale spheres of some sort of material, right? So zinc sulfide or cadmium selenide or lead sulfide or these weird like heavy metal, probably bad for you kind of things, where they're kind of made in layers. So there's a sphere of maybe zinc sulfide, and then on outside of it as a shell might be zinc oxide or one of these other things, and maybe they're even nested like layers. And what they do is their physical size has something to do with the emission that they produce. So instead of, like, the phosphor for that is going to be some pretty big molecule with a bunch of different possible emissions, and that's why you get this broad band. If you just make this quantum dot, which is this little sphere of a very, very consistent size, you're going to get an emission in a really narrow band. You're sort of like narrowing the probability of energy levels that phosphor can produce. So it's kind of a different mechanism. Like I said, big picture, it doesn't matter because it's going to just produce a lower energy color of some kind. But the practical result is you can synthesize a quantum dot that's going to emit a really narrow band green, and you can make another one that's going to emit a really narrow band red, and you can just put those in the plexiglass behind your display, light the whole thing with narrow band blue LEDs, and the lights you get out the front is the composite spectrum of the blue peak and this narrow green peak and this narrow red peak, which then of course makes your gamut triangle big, right? You make those colors very pure and narrow, and then your gamut triangle gets big. So quantum dots are used, the brand of QLED, QLED from Samsung, I guess, is that's one of the things they're doing. They're using quantum dots in their backlights to make a higher saturation primaries and a wider color gamut. Is that enough to answer your question about quantum dots? Because I don't know a whole lot more about the physics than that, but that's the short story. Sequential color, I already mentioned. I'll skip that, I guess. I do want to say something about multi-primary color systems. So a minute ago I was saying, well, what is a primary? Does it matter? I showed you maybe the idea that you had red, green, blue, and then a couple shades of white. You could also have lots of channels, right? This is a lighting system with, I think, 11 channels. I'm not counting, but this is a kind of research-grade lighting system designed to illuminate, you know, samples with very precisely defined spectral power distributions. So say, like, you wanted to make a really good simulation of D65, the standard illuminant. You basically figure out how much of each of these channels do you have to light up to give you the spectrum that is shaped like the dictionary definition of D65. You could then change the definition and make this look a lot like a tungsten light of 2850 Kelvin color temperature or anything else in between, right? So you have a, you can probably see that, right? If you kind of mix and match all these primaries, you can make a lot of different spectral combinations to do that.
Is there any drawback of having multiple primaries? Any drawback of having more than two primaries?
Yes, a couple drawbacks. One is, well, there's a bunch of, bunch of drawbacks, right? One is just solving for what I just said. I said that like it's trivial, but if you want D65 out of this, you've got to figure out, it's like an optimization problem to figure out what's the solution for this. You're trying to do a spectral match, but maybe that's not enough. So earlier when I said if you have three primaries, you have this 3x3 matrix. If you want a tri-stimulus match, you can just solve for the RGBs. If you want to make the tri-stimulus values of D65 with this, there are an infinite combinations of spectra that will give you that. So you need to make a new constraint. You need to add constraints to the system. And any, you know, spectral match is a decent constraint, but there could be others that you would want to do. Another is, I mentioned this is a lighting system. Nobody tries to make this into a display system, right? This is like one pixel with all these primaries, you know, in a big unit that's going to shine into your light booth. Squeezing that into a megapixel display is not happening anytime soon, so nobody's trying to do that. So these are... I've talked about before, like spectral resolution versus spatial resolution, right? So lighting systems, it's often interesting to have a lot of spectral control. For displays, you usually don't care, so you just want spatial control. You want fine detail spatially across the screen. That being said, there are displays with, you know, more than three, but not this many primaries. That's coming soon too, yeah. So going from RGB to, in this case, I'm drawing it like five channels, right? So it's still RGB, but now there's a yellow and a cyan. You could do that, five primary display system. You could certainly make that work. I've seen this kind of a display work before. It gives you more degrees of freedom, which means you can't do the matrix solution, but it might be useful for something else. You could use the cyan, say, to modulate your melatonin response with based on IP RGCs or something like that. Another drawback is the spatial resolution, because the upper one there, each group of three is a unit, kind of, right, in a pixel sense. But now the lower one, you actually now have five channels to make a unit, so somehow the spatial resolution is lower because you're trying to put more things, you're multiplexing more colors into the space, so you get less detail if you think about it that way. And then, that being said, this is, I really zoomed this in to show you and remind you that with kind of spatially distributed pixels like that, like in your normal display, they do a lot of tricks to distribute the luminance. Where, you know, this is supposed to be a black and white text, right? This is this at symbol, but you can see if you zoom in a lot, there's something orange over here and something blue over there, and that's because the subpixel rendering algorithm knows spatially where the red, green, blue stripes are and is putting just a bit of energy in the red but not the blue over there, a little bit of energy in the blue but not the red over there, to put the sort of visual center of the black, right? You want, this is essentially, you'd like this to be a smooth vector line, but you have to render it to pixels, so you're sort of trying to center it very precisely among the pixels you have, right? So this is a whole different class of algorithms and things that people have worked out. But the kind of thing that you need to pay attention to if you change the subpixel pattern from normal stripes to something else.
So what effect it has on luminance range? Is it enhancing the luminance or?
It depends, yes, because you know, the upper ones there, if you light up all red, green, blue together, you get white, essentially. If you light up all these, what do you get? You're adding red, green, blue, but now you're adding some yellow and cyan.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that biases your white somewhere else, so you can't actually maximize all the colors at once. When I worked on OLED displays, we had red, green, blue, and white. And basically, we would never light them all together. The only reason we had white was because it was more efficient than the RGB. So if you wanted to display white, you'd turn off the RGB and just light white. But if you wanted to light up red, you would just use the red and turn everything out, right? So never did we light up RGBW together because that was kind of pointless. But yeah, if you did that, then yeah, you'd sort of increase your dynamic range. That's kind of how these projectors do things sometimes. They add white on top of the RGB, which is bad for color reproduction. So. Make sense? Just to dabble in lighting systems again, these are three different lighting systems that have 5, 7, and maybe, I forgot, 13 primaries or something like that. You can see where these primaries are in the chromaticity diagrams. And then the spectra I've drawn here are different spectral reproductions of an AIM, which is D65. So the dashed line, sorry, the black and white dotted line is the same in all these plots. That's the goal of D65. And then the other colored lines are sort of different approximations of that goal using different constraints. So like I said, if you have more degrees of freedom with these more channels, this bottom set of plots, this bottom set of plots, if I'm trying to make that black one, well, arguably the green line is a good match, but maybe you prefer the red line, and maybe the blue line is worse. But if you're trying to, this blue line was to minimize the impact on your melatonin receptors. Right? The red one was to be the best spectral match, and the green one was to maximize color reproduction of objects under that light. Right? So there's different reasons why you might choose the different primary combinations. Right? And the point is that all of these spectral power distributions are the same color. They'll all look the same to you. They'll all look like D65 white, but they have different characteristics that have other effects. So. Make sense? So yeah, anyway, to get to the end where, again, sort of displays and lighting are the same and you have these different trade-offs, that's there. So I was going to end here and talk about observer variability a bit and observer metamerism. Any questions before I change topics?
Yeah.
Two different things, maybe. So you mentioned DICOM,
yeah?
So if you have a DICOM certified monitor from different companies, they should match because DICOM is like a rule.
Yeah.
So I would be surprised if there was a big variation between those. Okay. In the TV market, right, totally different from DICOM, then manufacturers do all kinds of crazy stuff, right? So Rec 709 is also a clear definition. Rec 2020 is also a clear definition. But these display makers say, oh, well, I can make the image look better, right? And they add all sorts of algorithms to improve the color, to mess with the color, to do this, that, right? And so then you get Samsung and LG and Philips and whatever all having different image reproduction. I would argue that they're all wrong unless they're actually implementing the rule like it's supposed to be. But they, for marketing reasons, they do, right? So I would think in the DICOM, I guess my summary is, I would think in the DICOM market that things would be pretty consistent. If you've experienced different than that, that's interesting and surprising.
Yeah, because there are some display systems that the color variation at times comes as a result of maybe acoustic perceptions.
Okay.
So errors in the design of maybe the color pipeline.
Okay.
The definition of the color pipeline. So
yeah.
I just wanted to know more about why it's.
Yeah. Don't know. Yeah, especially for DICOM, that would surprise me. I mean, Divi, you mentioned the color pipeline, and that's also worth saying. We're talking about the display as if it's just, you know, code values in to light out, but in fact, it's the whole system, really, from whatever program you're running, through whatever operating system that's there, through whatever graphics card and lookup tables and other junk and color management module, and all these things are in there. So when we talk about this relationship between code values and spectra or RGB, or sorry, XYZs, that's all there. And sometimes it's hard to separate those things. So in a DICOM sense, again, you should have the DICOM graphics card plugged into the DICOM monitor so that everything works. And the DICOM certified software to look at your images in, right? Those things should all go together. And I would think that in that market, those are better controlled than they are in the laptop market or the TV market. I do know, you know, I've measured a lot of laptops with students and things over the years, and I'm not advertising Apple, but Apple laptops have done a really good job with both matching or meeting the sRGB spec and being very consistent. So, I think they've done a good job. And maybe they were first to do that. Now I think, you know, Dell and HP have probably come up to a similar level of consistency and quality. But I would say like 10 years ago, things were all over the place, and Apple seemed to be a bit better than the others, but now maybe they've all gotten better, which is good.
Can you have a short break before we
move to the
next topic?
So you have till 1?
Yeah.
Okay.
But that will be just a short break, is that okay?
If we all don't mind staying after 1, just to, you know.
Yeah, okay.
We have class
1.
Okay, so
I can.
For one side, I think it's okay to continue.
Yeah.
Okay?
You guys all survive?
I mean, it's
yeah,
okay.
If you need to step out and come back, I won't mind.
I will join online because there is mandatory lecture.
Oh, okay.
But I will be.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for the questions. Okay, so just want to give you a introduction flavor to the sort of variations in visual sensitivity. I guess you've heard about color vision deficiencies, categorically, right? No? Okay. Something that you will talk about. Cool. So we all have cones. Which are roughly these sort of sensitivities. And again, these are sort of like probability functions, the probability of a given cone absorbing a photon based on its wavelength. And these are typical, these are average, something like that. So what I was gonna say about color vision deficiencies, if you heard the phrase color blindness or CVD, color vision deficiency, often that refers to someone like missing a cone, right? So if you're missing one of these cones, you clearly can't see three dimensions of color. You're going to have kind of a two-dimensional color experience, which is, you know, fine. Many people exist like that. Sometimes there are differences in the actual sensitivities where they overlap more or less. Those might be called a color vision deficiency, or they might pass for normal, meaning like performance-based. If you do a color vision test, you might not discover that difference is there. Or you might see a weird, you know, a small variation or something like that. That's possible. So we would still call that person kind of color normal, I think. And so basically what we've discovered, a bunch of people have discovered over the past maybe 15 years or so, is that our old understanding of sort of there was like normal color observers and colorblind people is, of course, much more nuanced than that, right? Like anything in height and skin color and other variations among people, there's a total gradient among people. So there are plenty of people who you would say have normal color vision, but they have variations that are just normal physiological variations. And then you start asking questions, well, what does that mean for performance, for displays, for lighting systems, for color reproduction, that kind of stuff. And so that's what we're talking about now. So these are, you know, decent representations of what we think the spectral absorptance or the behavioral spectral absorption of cones are. You probably have seen these curves, right? The color matching functions. And you thought to yourself, okay, there's some relationship between cones and color matching functions. You can arguably matrix between them. There's some nuances why that doesn't work perfectly, but that's there. You probably have also seen, right, that there's 2 degree versus 10 degree. Why is that? Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Do you know why they're different?
It's about the cones, like how many cones like you want to attract within the degrees. So like the degrees like more attracted to the cones.
Yeah. There are different differences in the cone mosaic in your eye. Mm-hmm. There's also the macula, which is essentially some yellow pigment right in the middle of your fovea. Seems kind of like a bad idea, right? So the fovea is the middle 2 degrees that basically you're sampling with the 2 degree observer. And then right there, that essentially overlapping that is this yellow filter that is some, you know, protein in your eye that's yellowish. And that macula tends to get yellower as you age. And your lens and the optical, or the fluid inside your eye, all of these things age and become yellow with age, right? So all of that means that things are going to be different. But so back to the angular difference, the macula is there, which is blocking some of the blue light, absorbing some of the blue light, which explains some of the differences here and on the short side of all these curves, right? There's less sensitivity for the, there's more sensitivity for the 10 degree observer because it's outside that macula, basically. So that's kind of weird. So then I just started to talk about some other things which we can look at here. This plot shows the same cone sensitivities, the blue, green, and red curves there. This black curve is the density of the macula. So density is the absorption, essentially log of the absorption. So it's absorbing this sort of nice blue light, which also lines up with your short wavelength sensitive cone, also lines up with the typical blue primary of displays, where you're just losing some of that light. And the other two curves here are the lens itself, which has some yellow absorption. And then this is sort of like a multiplicative thing on top of that. So as you age, this part gets bigger and bigger, so everything turns yellower. So these are sort of known physiological things that happen in your eye, where there's sort of some underlying cone sensitivity, but then it's limited by these other things here. So this is all been generated in the last, I don't know, 15 years. Andrew Stockman is the keeper of this data. These are known as these cones are known as the Stockman and Sharp cone fundamentals. These are newer, better measurements than were done back in the 1920s and 30s when the color matching functions were defined, right? Back then, we didn't have a good way to measure cones. So we did color matching because you can just dial in red, green, and blue and say, oh, that's a match for me. And then, by the way, that RGB is sort of a recipe for a color reproduction. And as long as you and I see the same, we can both dial in the red, green, and blue, and then we made a color match. Nowadays, we have the ability to measure cones, so that's what these are. And then, because so many people are used to using tri-stimulus values for everything, we have also made the transformation from these cones to these color matching functions. And now there's an extra set here. The solid and the dash are the new versions. So these are like the 2015 color matching functions, which can be compared to the 1931 ones. Yeah. So the shapes are recognizable. They're similar, but they're different, you know, right? And they're going to be different. And what this means is if you talk about like the definitions of most things like luminance or sRGB or whatever, they're all based on the 1931 curves. But it's like nowadays, we kind of know better. Like the 31 curves, they have some flaws. We know better now, but we haven't yet redefined all these things. So you have to, you're sort of stuck with the 1931 curves because they're there. But now if we were starting anew, we would probably use these better curves. So I mentioned age. So CIE 1970, I didn't fully say that either, but this is a document from the CIE that defines these cones and the transformation. And they also account for this age difference. So these are the normal 2 and 10 degree observer, but you can also for all 2-degree observers, look at what they would be at different ages. So that's kind of cool. So now there's a bunch of variation. And again, yeah, I didn't label them, but because everything gets yellower with age, all the curves push that way as you get older. So that's kind of funny. Yeah. This is all from the CIE. It's basically like a kind of a formula, linear combinations of the cones and the other sensitivities. So you can dial in, you can basically, it's sort of like, instead of there just being a 2 and a 10 degree observer, now it's like sort of a function, and you say, give me the observer for a given age and a given field size. So these are the ages for a fixed field size of 2. This is the opposite, fix the age at 32, which is the average in their world, and show the field of view dependence. So now this is from 2 degrees up to 10, or maybe even 1 degree up to 10 or something like that. So everything in between. So these are all sort of generatable from the CIE 170 document, which is already interesting. And it means things are hard, right? It was already hard enough to do colorimetry and define the measurements of a display, but now you need to be like, well, okay, I measured my display and I'm talking about the colorimetry for a 38-year-old with a 4-degree field of view. And somebody else is like, okay, that's annoying because I just want the color matching functions, you know, and now you've got to go find the right thing. But it gets worse, sorry to say. As I mentioned, there's variation, okay? So when I said age and field of view, that's an average, hopefully a good and unbiased average, but it's an average. So on top of that CIE definition, there's work, this Asano Fairchild and Blondet model from 2016 is kind of the most well-known one, but some other ones have happened since then. Where basically they say, okay, CIE 170 as a function of age and field of view is a good starting point, but then on top of that, there's some more variations you need to mess with, you need to put in, right? And those are this list of things here. The lens density, right? So at the front of your eye, you have a lens. Some people's lenses are a little yellower, some are a little clearer, fine. The macular density, again, at the back of the retina. Some people's are more dense than others. Okay, fine. Also, the cones themselves, they each have a pigment in them that actually absorbs the light. And some people just have more or less of that pigment, which kind of is the relative strength, I guess, or the absorption of those cones. And there are peak wavelength shifts possible, right? Especially in the medium and long wavelength cones, there are some, they've connected them to genetics as well. So you can actually test somebody's genes and figure out which cone they have in some cases. But even within that, there's some just random variation, right? Everything here is sort of a natural, you know, normally distributed process. So if the peak is supposed to be, you know, 552 nanometers, it might be, yeah, for you a couple of nanometers shorter, for you a couple of nanometers longer. And the point is all of this is totally normal, right? So then, what do you do with it? One answer is you can't possibly do it for every individual, so throw all this away and just use the average, right? And that's kind of what the 1931 solution was. It was like, well, whatever variation is, we can't even measure, so we're just gonna standardize it and call it that. But for some things, you do wanna know what the variations are, and in some cases, we're just curious, like, well, how much impact does this have, and how much difference would we expect over normal population? So the model that they generated has these parameters, and it also includes the idea of a Monte Carlo simulation. Does this make sense, this phrase, Monte Carlo? It comes from the gambling world, where you roll the dice. And it basically means that for each of these parameters, you have sort of a normal distribution, and you say, okay, I'm gonna generate a simulated observer, and I'm gonna roll the dice for lens pigment density. Hey, he's right on the middle, cool. I'm gonna roll the dice for macular density. Oh, that one's, you know, one standard deviation higher than normal, right? And you keep rolling the dice and you generate a fake observer, a simulated observer, which means drawing their cone sensitivities. And you can do that as many times as you want. Every time you roll the dice, you're generating a new observer. Because you're using physiologically measured distributions, these are all realistic observers. And you can end up with something like this. So here are 1,000 curves all overlaid on one another. These are all 32-year-old people. They're all 2-degree observers. And yet, the amount of variation you see here is bigger than the difference between 2 and 10-degree observer we were talking about a minute ago, right? So that says that whatever average you're using is not nearly a enough to describe these people, whatever. So these are the cones. Of course, you can translate those to color matching functions. You see something like this. And if you want to compare that again to the difference between the 2 and 10 degree observers, yeah, it's big, right? So what does this mean? It means that if I look at a color match, a metameric color match, so you guys know the definition of a metamer?
Under some viewing condition, they are the same. Another viewing condition, they are not.
Cool. Generalizing that, I would say spectrally different, but tristimulus match, yeah? So tristimulus match implies some sensitivity. So I have a set of metamers here that matches for me. You look at it and you're like, you're crazy, right? That's not a good match. Let's see. This is an illustration of this. This is from one of my PhD students looking at this, thinking specifically about displays, right? So here there is an LCD and there's an OLED, and the spectrum you see at the top, he's plotted both the RGB separate as well as the composite spectrum. So the black thing there is basically the white spectrum being shown on this display. And the one over there is the OLED spectrum. So again, spectrally different, but these are metamers for that person. See how happy she is? Yes, it's a good match. Somebody else walks in and they have a different sensitivity, and now there's a mismatch, right? So, and it's illustrated here basically. I don't know what the color difference is, but the idea is that it would be a mismatch for them. And then you end up with this weird argument. And this has happened, especially in the like very color critical world of like Hollywood movie production, where they have a really elaborate studio with calibrated displays, where the colorist does their work and the director looks over their shoulder and says, oh yeah, that's cool, I like this, I want more contrast, whatever. And they might have a standard OLED because it's very common, and they might also have an LCD because they want to make sure that when people go home and look at it on their LCDs that it also looks good, and they kind of grade it for that. And sometimes some of these studios also have a projection screen so they can sort of co-optimize everything together. And this argument has actually happened in these studios where somebody looks at the match between the LCD and the OLED and the director is like, what are you doing? Because these don't even match. And the colorist's like, what are you talking about? This match is great. Right, and then they like try to figure out who's normal and who's not, which is not the right argument, but the point is that they disagree, and that just leads to questions. So, why does this happen? And you know, why is it an issue now, right, compared to previously in the world? Part of it is because displays and lighting both have evolved a lot, and they've gotten more capable, and things have gotten spectrally narrower, right? Like your classmate mentioned something about narrow primaries. All of these spectral differences, you know, think about it. If you had a really broad reflectance of a leaf or something, right? Peaks in the green, something like that. None of these differences matter because the whole thing is broadband, right? If you have a narrowband blue LED, right, that happens to be on this side of here, it's going to be really bright for some of us and really dim for some of us because it's on the high slope area here. And then that slight shift in the sensitivity is going to make a big difference. So basically our tendency over the years to get to sort of more wider color gamut and narrower band primaries and steeper light spectrum and all these things all means that these differences become more apparent. So these are some cool diagrams from Roy Byrne's book, which I use in some of the classes about principles of color technology. Each of these boxes is the sort of color, you can kind of think of it as the color that someone would see, and there are 600 observers here, right? So same model, right? The Monte Carlo model with 600 observers. The top set of patches are the reflectance of human skin illuminated by daylight and observed by 600 different people, right? Do you see any different?
Yeah, you see a little difference, right?
It's all sort of just like a light skin, maybe a little bit of pink or green. The next block is if you took the measured XYZ of that and you reproduced it on an LCD display with a typical kind of Gaussian things, are they the same? So on average, they should kind of look like the same. I mean, if the color regression isn't perfect, but on average, they should be about the same. But you probably see more difference between those tiles in there. Yeah. Which is nice. But then, if you then put it on a laser projector, which again has the narrowest possible color primaries, now you see extreme differences, right? And that's the kind of thing that people started noticing. When you're looking at, you know, rarely maybe do you compare the physical skin illuminated with the LCD, but it's quite common, at least in this world of cinema, to have the projector and the display next to each other and be comparing them. And then, you know, for this person, maybe it matches great. For this person, it's like, what are you talking about? And this other person's like, but this person says, no way, it's totally green. And this other person says, what are you talking about? It's totally pink, right? And so three people think three totally different things. So it's the same, so we calculate XYZ tristimulus values using the standard observer.
Yeah.
If you throw away the standard observer and use each of these 600 observers to get an XYZ, you're gonna get slightly different XYZs for everyone, right? Okay. You turn each of those XYZs into RGBs to put on the screen, and you're gonna end up with slightly different colors. Okay. That's the idea. So it's sort of like measuring it with a different system because each observer is a different system. Yeah, okay.
Their own appearance.
Yeah, right, and this is a bit fakery, right?
Yeah.
Because any one of you is only one of these 600 people, right?
Yeah.
So if you are this person, you have no idea what these other people see. And this is the argument, right? Because I'll look at it and I'll say, oh, it looks fine. You look at it and you see green. We can never see what the other sees. And that's a problem. So one of my PhD students did a real study here on, like, as you make the gamut wider, of course, the primaries get narrower, all this gets worse, that's true. Another student earlier did this look at, these are sort of like clouds of the possible colors you get for a laser projector, versus his objective was to make a multi-primary system that would minimize this difference, right? Because if you make a broader band spectrum, you're going to sort of make people less sensitive to the differences. So these huge clouds get shrunk to these almost imperceivable clouds by his choice of primaries in the system, which is pretty cool. And then the last thing I'll say is, you might have observed in that set of colors that everything is kind of on this pink-green axis, which is a little weird, right? Like, we have more dimensions than that in color, yet everything always looks pink and green. And so this is a photo of these two light booths we have in our classroom at RIT. And this one is a broadband D65 white, and that one is a metamer made with red, lime, green, and blue. So sort of a four primary spiky thing. And then I took a picture of it with a camera, which, by the way, has a different sensitivity entirely than all people. And you see this huge difference, right? So that one's clearly pink, according to the camera. With my eyes, I thought these were a pretty good match. And I was in the same room with other people who thought the one on the right was green. Okay, so it really happens. Like, you get this number of people in the room, and you take a vote on who thinks it's pink and who thinks it's green, and it's just fun, right? Because nobody can agree. And it's only because these primaries are very narrow. But my point here was just to say, like, of all the possible hue angles, the differences that you get are always in the red and green, well, always primarily in the red and, or, sorry, the pink and green direction. And the real reason for that, I don't have the right plot here, but the real reason for that was over here, where it tends to be that if you have a spectrum that's kind of on this side over here, you have one that's on this side over there, so that when you have, how to describe it better? This is like the climax, and I'm not saying it right, but, like, basically the way things tend to move together, it's either like both the red and the blue go up, or they both go down, and that's why you sort of get this pinkish, greenish directionality in all of this. So if you're ever looking at LEDs or displays or whatever else, and you think, oh, it's a bit pink, or oh, it's a bit green, it might be poorly calibrated, or it might just be you. Yeah.
So during the setup with different subjects,
yep,
all of them were, you know, they could see different colors,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But then you took a picture with your phone, and you now put it on the projector.
Yeah.
everyone in the room still see the same color, or is everyone seeing different colors? So, I mean,
that's
my question is, when
yeah.
you look at a setup or the display
yeah.
with your eyes, but then you capture an image and then you look at the image,
yeah.
would you still, you know, experience metamedicine?
Not really. Right, and the reason is we're all looking at this projector with its own three primaries, and you're not comparing this stimulus with its spectral distribution with a different stimulus. Right, everything on this screen has kind of the same family of spectral behavior, and it's only in the actual light box where I'm able to create really different spectra that you're going to see these mismatches. So the difference maybe, you know, in delta E between the grayish and the pinkish here. What is it, by 5, 8, something like that? We all kind of see something similar there. So that's not the variability. It's also, by the way, between phones to phone cameras, right? Different people take the pictures, and some make a bigger difference, some make a smaller difference. But once that picture is captured, again, you're looking at the display on the phone, and it's going to be, it's only if you're comparing between light sources or between displays. Once everything's on a single display, it's kind of more constrained. So another place this comes up, I mentioned the cinema case, another place it comes up is in cars, because nowadays there's like a display behind the steering wheel, and there's a display over here with the radio on it, maybe there's another display down there, and if one of those is an OLED and one is an LCD, then you're going to get this kind of behavior and people are going to complain. So yeah, that's the end. Sorry for going a couple minutes late, but appreciate the questions and thanks for listening.
Questions?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yeah.
So Apple has introduced this Super Retina XDR display in their iPhone 14 series.
Okay.
So my question is, if I take a picture with iPhone 14 and you know, and upload it on social media, and a friend of mine, you know, views that
yeah.
on his smartphone, but his smartphone doesn't support XDR, do you think that person will be able to appreciate the image quality that, you know, iPhone has been trying to achieve with its photonic
yeah.
engine, its you know, old processing that they have been doing on A16.
Yeah.
So if not, then what's the point of companies running after, you know, improving their imaging system if not everyone has the same
yeah.
You know, displays to appreciate it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, in the olden days,
not
well, part of the answer is they would love everyone to feel like, oh, my phone isn't as good, so I should buy the iPhone 14. But I don't know if that's realistic. But yes, certainly you'll miss something, right? If you have a more capable display and you have the image pipeline to drive it well, and someone else doesn't have that, they're going to get a lesser experience, and that's nothing really you can do about that.
Okay, I think we need to close now.
Thanks.
So we'll continue tomorrow, 10:40, and then we are going to spectral imaging. Okay, thanks.
Cool. Thanks, everybody.
That was a great presentation. Thank,
thank
you.
You. There's some correlation because things tend to be sort of red, green, and blue. It's just where they differences happen when you're on the like high slope area of the cones, and it just sort of, maybe it's coincidence, but it's like you tend to have differences that activate the long and short cones together or the middle cones. So that long and short together is kind of pinkish, or the middle is just greenish. And so it's, I think it's just kind of a coincidence, but it's sort of like it happens all the time. So that's how you sort of.
So,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. Cool. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.